The term Habayim Mitzrayim, it should have said Asher Ba'o, that had come. You know, the Jews had been in Mitzrayim for decades before this pasuk is described. Why is it described in the present that are coming into Egypt? And that's twofold. Number one is the Jew has to understand their ultimate place is the land of Israel. No matter where we are, no matter how long we've been in a certain place, you're all familiar with the fact that the Chasam Sofer had in his tzava, his personal will to his descendants, not to build or live in a brick home. What was the idea? That no matter how long they were living, whether it was in Frankfurt or Main, and in the case when he moved to the Oberland, to Pressburg, Bratislava, that he or his descendants, no matter how long they'd been living in these places, it's temporary. Our place, our destiny, our permanent home is the land of Israel. That's the place for the Jew. And that had to be the perspective of the Jews. That's Habayim. There's a second insight there, and that is that from the perspective of the Egyptians, the Mitzrim, they always looked at the Jew as Aver. What does it mean, Ivri? What is an Ivri? You know, Paro was not familiar with Hashem Elokei Yisrael. He was familiar with Elokei HaIvrim. The Jew is always different. He's on the other side. He's from the other side. You know, like Avraham HaIvri. He was on one side, of not just geographically one side of the river, that he came from the other side of the Euphrates. It's more than that. His world outlook, his perspective, he's viewed as being something different, something unique. Very often it has a negative connotation, and that was the case with the Mitzrim. Okay? They never, no matter how much the Jews contributed to the welfare, to the benefit of that society, no matter the fact that it was Joseph who transformed that society into the state-of-the-art economy, into the top economy on the globe at that time, it didn't matter. The Jew was always a different. Now, it's interesting that, you know, when people are children, they're taught, okay, you know, like one day there's a new pharaoh and he enslaves everyone. It was not that simple. The Rav analyzed the psukim, and he showed that it was very, very calculated. It took a significant amount of time to change the culture and the psyche of the people. But there were three steps in what happened. Number one, the whole notion of Hava Nischak Malo, in the first Aliyah, the first Psukim, right? Let us deal very shrewdly with it. You know, if I want to, if I want to dehumanize someone, I don't refer to them by their name. You notice the Iranians will never say the word Israel, you know, the Zionist entity. They'll never say Israel. They won't call us by our name. The idea of let us deal very shrewdly. What was this? This was state-sponsored anti-Semitism. There's two types of anti-Semitism. There's grassroots, like you had in Poland. You know, where every priest in every parish, Sundays, whether it was Easter Sunday, whether it was the Xmas Mass, whether it was a regular church service, it was a religious country, and there was a whole culture of viewing Jews as Christ killers, being guilty of deicide, being the enemy, being the devil. And that was taught, you know, in villages and towns by the clergy. That's grassroots. Then there's something called grass tops, where it's driven by the government. You saw that with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. You know, Venezuela always had a good relationship with Israel. The people of Venezuela were not anti-Semitic to their Jews. It was driven from the government. That's what happened in Mitzrayim. Because what the government did was they were threatened by the fact that the Jews, right, Paru, Rabu, Yishritzu, Yirbu, Mimod, Mo, there was an exponential growth rate. Exponential growth rate. And not only did the Jews grow in numbers, the Jews grew qualitatively. They were taking over industries. They were at the cutting edge of various dimensions of culture, of industry, of branches of the economy, branches of government. Vati male ha'aretz osam. The land was filled with them. Not just in the sense that the Jews spread out from Goshen to all parts of Egypt, but that the Jews spread their influence because of their talents and their abilities. They were a threat. They were taking people's jobs, taking people's businesses, because they were talented, they were capable, and they were a threat. But what happened? The government played on the greatest fear the Egyptians had. See, they said there's a term that comes from General Franco, Generalissimo Francisco Franco, the famous dictator of Spain. He coined it a fifth column. What's a fifth column? You could have the best army and you could protect the borders, but if you've got an enemy within, in every town, every village, every city, what'll happen? You can't stop the enemy within. You can't identify them. They'll drive you out of your own land. Because even if you can try to protect the borders, you know, where do you identify that enemy? And that is the fear that he played on. After all, Egypt had the Nile River basin. It had the mineral riches of the continent of Africa. And this enemy within that, again, speaks a different language. They have different names. They dress differently. In other words, they're an identifiable enemy in the sense that they're different, but on the same time, you know, they're controlling every segment and sector of culture, of academia, of the economy. And he said they're the greatest threat. We have to be careful, because the fear of every Egyptian is that any country on earth envied Egypt. Egypt was the wealthiest country on earth, had the greatest military on earth. You know, if you want to knock something off, if you want to strive for something, it was Egypt. And that was a great fear in the mind of the typical Egyptian, and the Pharaoh played on that. The government played on that. And they took all of the strength, all of the beauty, all of the achievements, all of the impact of the Jewish people, and they turned it on its head, which has been done many times in history. The second phase was the following. You know, in today, we pay financial taxes. Even though there are multiple different types of taxes, they're all financial in nature. Capital gains tax, income tax, real estate tax, death tax, these are all financial in nature. Luxury tax, sales tax. But in antiquities, you had a phenomena called a labor tax. What is a labor tax? That each male at of a certain age goes out 3-4 weeks a year, and their job is to work on the public works projects. They build the highways. They build the dams. They build the storage cities, the silos. And you leave your family. Like today, Israelis have miluim. You literally have to leave your job, leave your family, leave your business, which has a huge economic impact, and you go spend 2-3 weeks on the base. Well, the Egyptians, what the government said is, listen, these people, they came here as a function of a famine. They would have starved to death. We gave them their life. We gave them everything. We opened up our country to them. And look at what they've done. They've come in, they've taken our jobs, taken our businesses, they've become wealthy only as a function of our largesse. Isn't it only right that they should show gratitude? Isn't it only right that they should be building Ramses, Pisum and Ramses, the storage cities? They should do the labor tax? They should be building the highways? And what Egyptian is going to say, no, it's not right. I want to be going out in 110 degrees to work in the middle of the day, building a highway, a road, where you're literally sweating to death, you're dehydrating. What Egyptian is going to want to say to them, oh, no, it's not fair. We should all do the labor tax. And people were very happy to let the Jews do the labor tax. That was stage two. And what that created and what that accomplished was a dichotomy. You know, Jews do labor tax, Egyptians don't. That was a huge jump, and that laid the ground for ultimately the enslavement. Vayavidu es b'nei Yisrael b'farach. They enslaved the Jewish people b'farach. We're going to have to define what that word means. But stage three, after decades of state-sponsored anti-Semitism, after decades of labor tax being done by Jews but not regular Egyptians, only then were the Egyptians desensitized vis-a-vis the humanity of the Jew. Only then were the Egyptians acculturated to looking at the Jew as different as other, having different set of standards for a Jew than a regular Egyptian. And that is when they went into the modality of slavery. Now that word befarech, so many of the Rishonim say it just means very hard work. And you could take that approach. But there's a medrash that says befarech, you know, think about the term farech as opposed to avodah kasha, hard work, difficult work. There's befarech is an interesting term. That's where we get the term apircha. What's a pircha? Pircha is not just a question. A question means, I don't understand something, can you explain this? A pircha means, I think your assumption is dead wrong, and I'm going to undermine the assumption that you're making. I'm going to challenge the very assumption you're making. That's what a pircha is, okay? It's that kind of a question. It's not a factual question. It's not a question that, oh, this seems to contradict something from over here. It's a question which challenges the assumption of your whole premise, okay? What's the idea of pircha? There's a medrash. It says that the medrash says the women were given back-breaking work, you know, you carrying boulders and heavy weights, and the men were set up as seamstresses, okay? Now, today, the notion of a Sicilian or a Napoleon tailor in Italy is a very fine craft. You know, some of the finest, most talented people with very good dexterity end up going into that business. And they create Ketone and Brioni, and they create all kinds of incredible clothing, men's and women's. That's a craft. In antiquities, men were not seamstresses. In antiquities, men didn't do that work. They didn't have fine motor coordination. They didn't have that kind of dexterity or fine motor coordination. Who did that kind of work? Women. But by having Jewish men do this, they accomplish nothing. Because they don't have the fine motor coordination, they literally accomplish nothing. And they're sitting there poking themselves with needles all day, feeling like they have no self-worth. And the women, the same thing. If they're 85, 90 pounds, they cannot be doing back-breaking work. They accomplish nothing because it's futile. And that was the idea of Avodas Perach. To create a malaise and a depression amongst the Egyptians amongst the Jewish slaves, that they would have no will to go on living, no will to have children, to build for... You're only going to have children, bring children into the world. You're only going to want to move forward when you're optimistic, when you're idealistic, when you think there's a better tomorrow. But if your life has no purpose, your life has no value, if you have no meaning and there's no reason to get up in the morning, then depression, then malaise sets in. And that's exactly what happened with the Jews. That is exactly what happened. And that was the goal of Avodat Perach. It was not strictly economical. It was to break the psyche of the Jews. This was the methodology. And if you look at what happened in Nazi Germany, Julius Streicher with Der Stürmer, the stormtrooper, was the free newspaper that was given out. It was the most read newspaper in Germany. You had Joseph Goebbels. The only way that people got the news is they went to the movie theater. No one had television. To see what's happening in the world, they went to the movie theater, and you had these propagandas. Part of the Nazi Party, they had a whole film division that would produce this propaganda with the pseudoscience to show that Jews were not human, that like rats, they were a threat, they were predators on society, that they were a disease, a cancer. And you had this for years. They changed the textbooks. Before you had any pogroms, before what we call Pogromnacht, or what the Germans referred to as Kristallnacht, before that you had 6 years of terrible, terrible propaganda, of Jews being disbarred, Jews being precluded from academia, Germans not being allowed to go to a Jewish doctor. You had all of the legislation, all of the education, all of the propaganda creating a fertile soil where a Jew is different, where a Jew is despised, where a Jew is a threat, where a Jew is a cancer. The Nuremberg Laws of 1935. These are the kind of things that happened to lay the fertile soil for ultimately physical abuse and then eradication and annihilation. And that's exactly what was done by the Egyptians. I'm skipping, and I would just ask, it's about 44 pages, that you look at the Masoros HaRav Chumash, because the richness of the material over the years that was compiled from the Rav Shiurim on Shmos, it would take us 4 or 5 hours to do it, and we only have a few minutes. So I can't do justice to the incredible richness, which is true of almost every Parsha in Brachos, almost every Parsha in Shmos, when the Rav for years in Boston were giving these 2, 2.5 hour Chumash Shiurim at the Maimonides Yeshiva every Saturday night. Not to mention other shiurim to the Talmidim at Yeshiva, shiurim at Maria on Tuesday nights, 80th Street and Broadway in New York, in Manhattan, when he gave the Chumash Shir. There's just so much rich material. We're going to take 2 ideas. One is the phrase, Achein Noda Hadavar. When word gets back to the Pharaoh, by who? Who spread the word? It was 2 Jews. Our tradition, Rashi quotes, is Dasan and Aviram. 2 Jews ratted out Moshe. Who did what? Vayar besiv losam. He left the comfort. He left the luxury of the royal palace. And he went to see these poor, wretched slaves and how terribly they were suffering. And he went and he was concerned for their welfare. And then he goes and he saves the life of an innocent man, a man he'd never known, will never probably see, never seen before, will never see after. He risked everything. You know, he looked at himself, Vayifen ko vako. He looked at himself and he says, you know, right now I'm hidden, I'm camouflaged. No one will know that I'm here. If I don't do anything, this innocent man will die and probably his wife will die in the aftermath of that. But, you know, down the road in 10 years, if I have more of an influence in the government, I could save hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of these Jews. But he doesn't do that. This innocent man has done nothing. There's no reason that he should be beaten to death by the Egyptian taskmaster. Vayifen ko vako. And Moshe saves the man. And he smites the taskmaster. But of what happened? 2 Jews go and rat him out to the government. Now he says, Achein no da hadavar. This is the 2nd explanation Rashi gives. Now to me the matter is known. What matter is known? Not the matter that I killed the Egyptian to save the Jew's life, but the following matter. It was the theodicy question that Moshe always asked himself. How can it be that this people, of all people on earth, you know, why do they suffer? Look at the morals of the Egyptians. Look at the ethics of the Egyptians. Why are they allowed to perpetrate such evil on this people that is innocent, that is decent? And when this happened, he realized, I've misread this people. Now I understand who this people are. And what did he do? He realized, you know, he gave up on the Jews. He risked everything, and they threw him under the bus, and he fled. The Medrash says that he fled. Where are you going to flee? Mitzrayim is the northern third of the African continent. Where are you supposed to flee? So the Medrash says that he fled to Kush, to Black Africa, Central Africa, and he lived there for decades. And after having an incredible role of transforming, you know, the quality of life and the welfare as a governmental servant there, as a man who implemented many of the skills he learned in Mitzrayim as a young man, he settled in Midian. He settled in Saudi Arabia. He becomes a son-in-law of the Kohen Midian, whether Yisro was an archbishop or whether Yisro was a cattle baron. It depends on how you interpret the word Kohen. Kohen can mean like a priest, an archbishop, or Kohen can mean a member of the aristocracy, a member of the leadership. But whatever the meaning is, whatever the meaning of that word is, you know, he settled down. He's in private business. He's the CEO of this huge cattle herd, of this huge corporation that has hundreds of shepherds for the sheep. And he's long forgotten the terrible experience he had in Mitzrayim, the fact that he was ratted out by the very Jews that he tried to save. Well, Hashem comes to him in the Sneh. In the Sneh, there's an incredibly rich number of midrashim on what's the imagery of the Sneh. But the Rav explained many of these midrashim, and he explained the psukim, that God appeared bilabas esh. What's labas? Rashi says in the heart of the Sneh. In other words, where was the fire? It was contained in the center of the Sneh. Now the Sneh is what? It's thicket. It's thorn bush, meaning the periphery is this worthless type of wood. You can't build it. You can't use it as firewood. It's basically worthless wood, but it's got, in the center, it's got open space. And belev, belabas, in the heart, is where the fire was. And Moshe says, Madua lo yivar hasna. Why is it that the laws of physics determine that if there's a fire, it needs, by definition, fuel for the fire to keep going? Well, the fuel is in the periphery. It's the thicket. It's the thorns in the periphery. The center has nothing. So why doesn't the fire consume the periphery? It's contained in the center, belabas, in the lev, in the heart. And that's madua lo yivar hasaneh. Why is it that the part that should be burnt is not being burnt? Lo yivar hasaneh. That was the maragadol. It was something that defied the laws of physics. He was perplexed by that. And Hashem says, ra'o ra'isi. What's ra'o ra'isi? So Rashi quotes the Midrash. I see a little deeper than you see. You looked at the Jews and all you saw was a sneh. All you saw was this worthless, wretched, bitter people. And you assumed that they had no fire. All the fire had been snuffed out. There was no... Because remember, what is a fire? A fire provides warmth. A fire provides light. It illuminates. You assumed that they were cold and dry and dead. And you abandoned them. Achein noda hadavar. But Hashem says, ra'o ra'isi. I look a little deeper. Moshe, don't look at the surface. Moshe, don't look at the superficial perception that you may have had of them. There is still a fire. Like this sneh. On the outside, they are wretched. They are scratchy. They are worthless. That's what it looks like on the outside. But inside burns a fire. But inside is contained a source of heat and light, and there's potential. And I need you to take that fire and bring it to the surface. I need you. Why you? And he says to him, Ki zeh ha'os. What is a sign, Kanochi shlachticha? When Moshe questions, you know, who am I? Why should I be the one? He says, I'm not looking for an Abba Ibn or a Michael Oren. I'm not looking for an orator, okay? I understand your kvad pen, kvad lashon. I'm looking for a mentor. I'm looking for an educator. I'm looking for someone who can have an impact on their lives and bring all their potential, that fire that is encapsulated within, to bring it to the surface. Look a little deeper at them. See their potential. You're the man to do that. And what is the sign? Tavdun es ha'elokim al harazeh. The sign that I've chosen you is that you're going to come back to this place. Not you, the CEO of your father-in-law's corporation. You're going to bring them back to this place for the ultimate act of avoda. The ultimate act of avoda is going to be the Kabbalah Satorah, where they encounter me, where they come to know me, where they come to adopt my system of ethics, my system of morals, my system of theology, of philosophy, where they leave the realm of being B'nai Noach and they become B'nai Yisrael. That covenant that will be fulfilled, that will not only change the future of them as a people, individually and as a nation, but it will change and transform the destiny of humanity. You are the man to do that. You are the mentor. You're the teacher. I'm not hiring you to be a diplomat. I'm not hiring you to be a politician. I am appointing you as my personal agent. Zeh ha'os ki anochi shlachticha. That I have sent you. You've become my plenipotentiary, my agent, to transform them as individuals, as a people, which the ripple effect will be the transformation of human history, the transformation of the destiny of all of humanity. And that's why I've chosen you. And you'll come back. And the sign that it will work, you will succeed, is you will return to this place. Tavdun es Elokim. They'll come to, what does it mean to worship God? To become God's avadim, God's committed servants, through Matan Torah, through Kabbalah Satorah. And that experience, there can be no geula, no redemption of the Jewish people, until Moshe becomes a believer in the potential of the Jewish people, until Moshe sees what the Jewish people are capable of. Only when that happens, and that's the whole imagery of the experience of the sneh. And the other imagery is, there are many, but I'm quoting the last one that we're quoting today. Imo anochi v'tzara. Where does God appear? In a wretched, worthless thicket in a snare. God is with the people no matter where they are. No matter where they are, no matter how difficult and how destitute they are, God is with them. Shechinta begalusa, imo anochi v'tzara. He is with, I am with the nation in their time of greatest need, in their time of dire straits. And that was also a lesson, that as long as God is with these people have a chance. Moshe, you've got to believe. Once Moshe starts to believe in the people, then all of history has changed. And then there's a future for Am Yisrael and for humanity.